So we felt that the divalent sulfides would probably be much more effective. And THS had been known and was very refractory. And so we decided, and we took cerium because it was most readily available and the cheapest of the lanthanides there. And we looked for it and we discovered that it did have a divalent sulfide as we expected. And it was very refractory, and we worked out techniques for making it. And we were very fortunate there in that in the Manhattan Project, there were people from a lot of fields and they tried to help one another. And there was a fellow at Los Alamos who had worked for one of these metallurgical companies in Chicago where they did powder metallurgical preparation of materials. And we would call him up and he would give us advice which he wouldn't have given us if he were working for a commercial company. And so we got really top techniques for powder metallurgical preparations.
Well, it was only, it was less than a year that before you were sending them to Los Alamos?
Oh, yeah. Well, we worked 24 hours a day. There were four of us. The three students, they had just gotten their bachelor's degree and wanted to come to Berkeley for graduate work. Instead, were enticed into the Manhattan Project. And very fortunate that to have three such talented people.
That was, who were they?
Well, Brownlee and Lofton and Gillis.
Gillis, okay.
Yeah. And they were top notch, and we kept sort of going 24 hours a day.
Yeah. Well, you had...
And here, I don't know if I had that. Oh yeah, here it is. This was from this book that was published from Los Alamos. Now the interesting thing about that I've emphasized in my paper, he makes it sound as if it was an accident that we happened to have them there, and didn't give Latimer credit for anticipating that they would have this problem when they first started.
Yes, this sounds that says, fortunately, an exotic one, cerium sulfide, had been studied by the chemistry group at Berkeley for use in vacuum at high temperatures, and they willingly gave us a supply of small crucibles. You were purposely doing
it. Oh, yes. I was designed to meet that problem.
Then it says, first they were made first here at Berkeley and then later at MIT.
Yeah, they set up a factory at MIT then, using our techniques.
What was it? I guess I'm looking for some indication of what it must have been like to start from scratch, produce, you had to build equipment to make these, work at high temperatures and everything else, and you had no background, real background
not
in that area.
Right, huh? But the group had a lot of talent, and even though they had no experience, they were willing to try. In fact, John Kubitakis had interesting experience along this line. We built a very unique high temperature vacuum system and worked beautifully. What were we doing? We used high frequency electric fields to generate heat. And we wrote up some papers describing this, and they were to be published in volumes of this type. But they didn't sell enough of them, so they didn't publish any of the others. Mm. So our equipment that we used was never published. And John was recently looking through some of our old reports, and And when he visited Arizona State recently, it was right, and they wouldn't believe that you could do what we did. So maybe we ought to publish that even 50 years later. But we had an apparatus in which the crucible we were heating was heated to above two, some of our crucibles heated above 2,000 degrees by in a Pyrex container, which was water cooled, and then the coil around it that was generating electricity. And the reason we could do that is we went through very elaborate calculations on how much heat it would take if we had proper radiation shields around it. And we use metallic radiation shields, which people don't believe because that would generate heat, but we had it arranged so that there wasn't a completed surface. So they act as very effective radiation shields, but didn't absorb much of the electric field. So we were able to get a very high temperature with a relatively small input of energy. So we calculated that the interior walls of the Pyrex wouldn't get over 150 degrees. Mm. And it really worked beautifully. People these days don't believe that would work.
Something else to put on your list of papers to be published.
Yeah.
Who coined the name impervium that you used to?
Oh, I don't know which of the group, but we were so impressed we could cast uranium in it and titanium and all sorts of things and nothing would touch it until that catastrophe would flatten.
Yes. we'll get to that a little bit later, but that must have been quite a surprise when that happened.
But that, as I mentioned, I think, in one of the iron lectures, led to the change in, one of the things we were supposed to do is develop the method for analyzing plutonium for oxygen content. That turned out not to be important. That the time we started, they were thinking of a bomb design in which the oxygen content would have to be very, very small. And they later abandoned that. But anyhow, at the time we started, it was important to have a method for analyzing the oxygen content of plutonium. And we started out using a molten bath of iron in a graphite crucible. And we would drop uranium in, and the oxygen would react with the graphite and come off as CO, which we could then determine the amount of it. Except it didn't work, because the uranium was vaporizing out of the iron and reacting with the CO. And when we found that the platinum reacted so strongly with cerium, it pulled the cerium out of these very stable crucibles. After we had worked out the thermodynamics, and we could calculate the cerium platinum compound must be very stable, we thought, well, maybe uranium will do the same. So we used the platinum bath, and it worked beautifully. Boy, the uranium wouldn't vaporize out of that because it reacted so strongly with platinum, just the way cerium did. So we worked out a very nice technique which analyzed the nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen.
The amount of work that came out of that early Manhattan Project is really quite impressive, the work that you did, as you just showed in that volume there.
Well, that was true of the Manhattan Project as a whole. If you see, go through what was achieved in such a small time, one couldn't imagine doing that these days. But one of the factors was that they really had outstanding people. We had all these people who left Europe because of Hitler and wanted to escape there, and they were really top-notch people, and it's amazing what they achieved in such a short time.
Of course, financial support was no problem either.
Yeah, we were able to get back to our past. No problem at all.
That probably makes a big difference, considering today's world and what it's like to get support. Why?
And now platinum is commonly used. Mm-hmm. Although we never published that people heard about it and used it.
Many of these papers from the Manhattan Project were published right after the war. Were they declassified that quickly?
Well, not quite after the war. For example, it took a while to get them declassified, and this finally came out in 1950.
Okay.
It took a while.
You mentioned earlier the graphite controversy, with Pauling's dismay at your at your results, and you've also mentioned Hertzberg's refusal to accept that. That's an interesting example of. Well, I remember a paper years ago titled "Resistance by Scientists to Scientific Discovery."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very common.
And of course, the nitrogen work, which came shortly thereafter, was another example of that. Here, you have two people who are acknowledged experts in the field, discounting your results. You said it took 10 years before they finally believed.
Well, Pauling can be very rigid as far as changing his view. See, it's very hard to budge him.
Did you have any personal contact with Hertzberg on this matter?
A little, yeah.
What was it that finally brought them around? Was it?
Oh, well, so after we published that, and some people saying, well, that's crazy, let's check it out, and there were many confirmations, no question. But the general attitude of most people was, in fact, but Gillis wanted to present a paper at a special conference on this, and they said, oh, that's crazy, we don't want to spend any time. Something like that. So that's very common. People get into a rigid framework, and even though they run into a lot of contradictions and so on, you finally have to get a drastic collapse out of the system to get them to take a new point.
Well, it's interesting because so often one thinks of scientists as being open-minded and more altruistic about their attitude towards new data and new information. But here we have a case where that was not so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yet the truth will out in the end, I guess.
Well, it's very common. I can't remember his name. It was a fellow at Harvard that wrote a book about philosophy of science and so on. He goes through this in quite some detail. It's hard to change. In fact, Jim Lewis had this problem. I don't know if you ever heard the story about him. He always had all sorts of new ideas when he was at Harvard and MIT, and oh, they just squashed them and said, that doesn't fit in with accepted view. And he was so upset that he quit, took a job, a federal job in the Philippines, and while he collected his thoughts. And then he heard about this position in Berkeley. He decided, well, maybe I could start a different atmosphere here. And he came to Berkeley, and one of the conditions for him coming here was that the university would provide some financial support for research. And came here, and he saw the budget that was published, and oh, he was so angry, he went down to the president, you didn't keep your promise. And the president said, calm down, calm down. Here it is, miscellaneous. And he set up a different atmosphere here. And Joel Hildebrand used to tell the story of his first experience here. He came from the University of Pennsylvania, which was very Germanic. You would never question a professor's view. And he came to the first seminar, and the procedure was, after the speaker had finished, G.M. Lewis would make some remarks, which he did, and some graduate student, back stood up, says, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, that's all wrong, it should be something. Hildebrand said he was terrified, what was going to happen to this graduate student? And Jim Lewis put his cigar down and turned him. Very impertinent remark, young man, but very pertinent. And then him and Van knew this was going to be a different atmosphere.
Do you think that attitude still prevails today?
It is hard sometimes to change point of view. For example, on this business of this model, using the metallurgy, there's a lot of resistance to that. I don't know, did you read any of my accounts of Engels?
Yes.
His difficulty in getting it even published, let alone accepted. In fact, I just had a paper review in which I was pointing out the need for expanding our predictive models and so on. And one of the reviewers said, I guess we have to publish it, but it only works 95% of the time. So he was raising objections to something like that.
One of the names that shows up in some of that early work was F.A. Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Jenkins?
He was a professor in the physics department.
Okay.
And again, as I was mentioning before, we had much more interaction with people in other departments in those days. And Gillis used several techniques for studying this, and one was a spectroscopic technique, and Jenkins was a spectroscopist. And we built a special piece of equipment for studying the spectrum of carbon species. We also had to consider the possibility was the vaporization due to dimers and trimers as well as the monomer. And we had a very effective collaboration with Jenkins there. And in fact, the physics department gave us a laboratory in which we could work, and I retained that research space for about 40 years. Until finally they were getting a little pressed for space, and they said, well, we have to ask you to move. So I have a lot of graduate students do their research work using that equipment in physics. And I've had very successful collaborations with other departments in geology, and in the metallurgy and material science department, and nuclear, and I've often used their facilities, set up equipment there.
Get my list out. You had an early paper in the Journal of Chemical Education in which you were imploring physical chemists. This was utilization of equilibrium vapor pressure data. And you said the following: it is a simple matter to develop equations which will permit accurate predictions of delta H and so on for outside experimental, far outside the experimental temperature range. Most thermodynamics texts don't tell you really much about it or how to do it. You were imploring physical chemists to...
Well, Pitzer and I updated the Lewis Randall book, and our thermal books really goes through that temper detail.
Well, while you're mentioning your update of Lewis and Randall, how did that come about? I mean, Lewis and Randall still talked about as being the epitome of a thermodynamics text.
Yes, that played a very important role. Part of Lewis really had a tremendous effect on not only here but country and science around the world. And one of these was in thermodynamics and its power.
Well, how did you and Pitzer come about to revise it some, 20 years later or whatever it was?
Well, for teaching thermodynamics, we needed a more up-to-date text. And So both of us had been teaching in the third language course here, and we decided to update it. But we tried to keep the spirit that Lewis had presented there. McGraw-Hill has been after us for years for another edition. And I would always tell him, well, the first edition was in 23, the second edition 60. Come around and see us in the 90s. So they laid off this one, but they've been around recently. So we've agreed to do it, but boy, I haven't had any time. Pitzer's actually done a little work on it, but I've been so tied up, I haven't been able to do my part.
1950, you had a sabbatical at the Imperial College. And that's when you did the nitrogen.
Yes.
How did you select going to the Imperial College?
Gayden was the man I was interested in. He had done some very interesting spectroscopy and had some, again, a person who didn't stick to the established format and came out with a lot of new ideas and so on. And I worked with one of his graduate students to get some results that indicated M2 should be more stable than accepted.
I wasn't clear. You had one paper with Templeton and Jenkins and Jax on the dissociation energies of N2. Then the paper with Gayden came later. And I wasn't sure what the sequence was.
What paper was this?
Paper number 29.
Oh, that was on CN, yeah. Lilo Templeton. One of my graduate students, and again, we use that equipment that we have over there. And we were trying to get some idea through, although it wasn't really definitive, it really wasn't convincing.
And, so this preceded your going to
England? That's right.
Okay.
But it didn't really give us the answer, the definitive answer. But the subsequent work, I think, did.
Now, there again, there was the values you came up with were not the accepted values.
That's right.
Did you have the same problem as you did with the graphite?
Not as strong, but the people were reluctant to accept it.
It wasn't a 10-year wait, though, as it was with that.
That's right.
Now, at the same time, well, your second graduate student, Lofgren, Cooper's chloride polymers.
Yeah, that was very important. We were using this model. In fact, we predicted the vapor pressures of all the halides and so on. There were some problems, and Cooper's chloride was one of them, where our model didn't seem to work. We weren't considering these very complex polymers at high temperatures. So I had to tackle that to find out what was really going on with Cooper's chloride. According to the literature, it was a dimer, Cu2Cl2. Well, we found out it wasn't. It was a trimer. But it turned out the trimer was very stable, and from his results we realized our model was incomplete and we'd have to modify it. And people still are upset by what we say. We say that if you have an equilibrium between a condensed phase and a gaseous phase, as you go up in temperature, the vapor gets more complex. There are more different species and their size will increase. People keep saying, oh, we know from thermodynamics that as you go up in temperature, the big molecules will break down. But they're thinking of a constant pressure situation. And of course, as you raise the temperature, the vapor pressure goes up. And we're able to look at the model that shows clearly that, and we have now been found, people are finding all these complex species at the high temperatures. And this causes a lot of trouble in technology, because they try to predict what will happen at high temperatures for what they've experienced at low temperatures, and they get all these surprises. And,
well, this becomes very important in today's material processing.
Oh, yes. And people now are recognizing these complex gaseous species.
So that work was going on actually, what, before you went to England, or they're about the same time?
Oh, yeah. Well, before. Lachlan started on that right after the end of the war.
Okay. How did you get into that area? That's still a follow-up from your model then?
Yes.
Original model.
That's right. To correct it. Now we find two situations with these predictive models. We find contradictions all the time with stuff in the literature. And the question is the literature results wrong, experimental errors, or is our model wrong? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other.
What's the percentage? Is your model better, more than 50% correct?
Oh, yeah. Pretty good. In fact, let's see if I have it here. There's I don't know if I covered that in any of the stuff you read, but give you an idea. Yeah, here it is. Did I describe that? And many of stuff you I predicted the electronic configurations of the actinides all the way to Lorentzian, and I sent these results to Los Alamos, and oh, they were very upset. It didn't fit in with their ideas, as you can see from this.
That's interesting.
But they finally had to come along. But it was a very simple thing. They assumed that Lorentzian would be like lutetium, which is the corresponding lanthanide. In the case of lutetium, the ground state is a DS2. But as you increase your nuclear charge, and as you go through the actinides, the S and P electrons are more strongly affected than the D, because the S, you know, go right through the nucleus, and the P go in front of it, whereas the D, I like to describe it, just going around outside. So that, according to my model, the P would be stabilized over the D, and you'd get an S2P. Mm. And the Los Alamos people have been assuming all along that it would be the same as increasing.
That's interesting.
In fact, asking on predictions,